we on?
We are.
Okay. All right. Good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The time is 9:35. The date is Wednesday, April 6, 2016. And we're meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State on behalf of Wayne Williams, Fred Yarger, Solicitor General, Designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Sharon Eubanks, Designee of Director of Office of Legislative Legal Services, Dan Carton. Also seated to my left, far left, is Steve Ward from our Elections Division, and to my far right is Grant Sullivan, our attorney from the Attorney General's Office. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is being broadcast over the Internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the Title Board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the Board will follow three steps. First, Board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the Board understands the proposal. Second, the Board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the Board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the Board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the Board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the Board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we'll take all testimony first, then the Board will discuss and vote after all testimony has been completed. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the Board. Please take note, we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the Board to set titles or to the correctness of the titles and the summaries themselves. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the decision of the Title Board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. In the interest of brevity, speakers may incorporate remarks made on the record in prior hearings on similar measures. The first item on the agenda today is a rehearing on proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 107, Colorado Redistricting Commission. If the proponents could first come forward and identify yourselves for the record.
Okay. For the record, I'm Kathleen Curry, one of the proponents for initiative number 107.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Frank McNulty, proponent for initiative 107.
Kelly Duke, on behalf of proponents from Ireland, Stapleton, Pryor, and Pasco.
Okay. And then we have two objectors. We've had motions for. If they could come forward, introduce yourselves, and then we will talk about your opposition motions for rehearing.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Gruskin with the law firm of Recht Kornfeld, PC, appearing on behalf of objector Donna Johnson as to one of the motions for rehearing.
Okay, thank you. And then we also have a motion that was filed by Kelly Duke. Go ahead. You're the objector.
Objector, yeah. Good morning. Jason Legg, file on my own behalf. Motion for rehearing.
Okay. Oh, okay. Those are attorneys for proponents. All right. All right, Mr. Gruskin, let's start with your motion for rehearing. Is there anything that you wanted to add to the motion that you had filed?
Yes, Madam Chair. I provided Mr. Ward a memorandum this morning, and he was going to transmit it to you. I think it might be helpful if the Board has that memorandum for me just to walk through it. And I sent it to you. Did you get it?
Yeah. Is it? No.
It's this way.
Oh, thanks.
In this memorandum of law, I've attempted to provide the Board with some legal authority in as much as I thought it would facilitate the conversation about the three primary arguments why this measure violates the single subject requirement in the Colorado Constitution. Number one, legislative reapportionment and congressional redistricting simply are not part of the same subject, even though they are lumped under the very general single subject description of redistricting in Colorado. As a matter of fact, as the board knows, the process by which the legislative districts are redesignated isn't even referred to as redistricting. It's called reapportionment, and that's a constitutional matter. But what is important is that reapportionment itself, Colorado Supreme Court has held that the subject of reapportionment in a multi-subject referred measure is its own subject. And that was a case from 1975. And I will grant the title board that this was not the core issue about which the Supreme Court ruled when it considered amendments number 6 and number 9.
Well, not only that, it wasn't about single subject. It was about severability, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And what were the other subjects that Amendment 6 addressed?
Amendment 6 dealt with a variety of issues relating to legislative prerogatives in terms of per diem allocation. There were executive branch authority issues. There was the issue of the legislative, the call for the legislative session. A number of them had to do with the legislature, and a number of them did not. The point here is that...
So can we, I mean, I saw that citation, and I quickly read it because we received this late this morning. I mean, what can we take from that 75 case? It seems like it's completely irrelevant.
Well, I guess we differ. I don't think it's completely irrelevant. I think what the court said was that legislative reapportionment was a separate matter because the issue raised in that case, and the reason the court addressed it, was because the issue was whether or not the legislative single subject requirement somehow invalidated the referral to the voters of all these various subjects. And the court basically said, as you point out correctly, Mr. Yarger, they could sever the reapportionment from all the other subjects, and they weren't going to consider the single subject consideration because the fundamental issue in front of the court at that point was whether or not there was a conflict between Amendment 6 and Amendment 9. But the point is, that is an outflow of the legislative requirement from which the initiative requirement for single subject flows. And as the board knows, the statute governing the application of the single subject requirement for initiatives is specifically to follow the case law that has been that has applied the legislative single subject requirement. Even if you don't get there, the more fundamental issue is that these are two sources of public policy that emanate from entirely different sources, one the federal constitution, one the state constitution. And in any event, every time they have been addressed, they have been addressed separately. And the processes are inherently different. And the courts have acknowledged that, both in terms of the considerations that are employed and the measure itself has two very different set of criteria for two very different processes. But the purpose is different. The purpose of reapportionment is to somehow minimize political influence on legislative district setting, whereas the Supreme Court, and just in the last cycle, the Supreme Court acknowledged that the purpose of congressional redistricting is not that. It is about the fair and effective representation of all citizens. And therefore, it is about representational value. It is not about some sort of political perception about the appropriateness of line drawing. And I would argue and suggest to you that the Supreme Court has sent a signal that these are different in nature and kind, and that they can't simply be lumped in any more than water or petitions or the judiciary in the would be an apt single subject. And I'd remind the board of the case law that exists relative to the attempts to change certain judicial appointment processes and then also on a corollary basis change the Judicial Performance Commission and the qualifications for those commissioners. It is exactly the same analysis. Secondly, and this is actually a more narrow but frankly more apt ground for finding that this measure violates the single subject requirement. What this measure does is say that there are certain people who cannot serve on the commission. That is a form of political involvement, like it or not. It may be appropriate or not, but it is nonetheless a form of political involvement. This measure says no lobbyist, no registered lobbyist, can serve on the commission. That includes professional lobbyists and volunteer lobbyists, including someone who simply registers because they believe in good government. The Supreme Court, in connection with an initiative dealing, or several initiatives dealing with the initiative process itself, said that the process of petitioning and getting on the ballot is different than limiting and excluding the right of any professional category from participating in that process. In the case that we cite in the memo, the proponents of an initiative sought to exclude all lawyers from being ballot title setters. There is no difference between these two matters. The court there said it was a fundamental political right that you could not hamper by winding it in with another process and a process change. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Well, I don't other of the measures for which we've set title exclude certain classes of persons from sitting on commissions? And how is this any different?
I can't answer whether or not there are such measures. I would simply say that what this does is radically change, and the proponents intend to radically change the process in terms of who makes the decision, in terms of what the criteria that will be used, in terms of the appellate mechanism, in terms of the transparency mechanisms. All of those processes are new as to redistricting, except for the criteria that are incorporated either from statute or from the Constitution. This is exactly that. That's exactly the same kind of initiative petition change that was considered in the case we cite, number 32 and number 33. You cannot simply exclude people who happen to register for the League of, because they're with the League of Women Voters, and they talk to legislators. You cannot exclude them by the same measure. You can't exclude them, but you simply can't do it by the same measure. And lastly, as we suggest in the memo, basically to say that you cannot set your own district lines, it seems to me, is related. So a congressperson ought not be able to set his or her own district lines, likewise a legislator. But to say that you cannot set someone else's district lines and therefore add a qualification to serving in office, that is that you are not a member of this board, goes beyond the single subject authority. And I will leave it there and ask if there are questions either about this or about the clear title arguments that we raise that we think are important and need to be addressed as well, if the board doesn't agree with us on single subject.
Any other questions? Mr. Legg, did you have anything you wanted to add to the motion you filed?
Thank you. I don't have anything more to add to the motion we filed. Just I'm available for questions if they arise.
Okay. Is there anybody signed up to testify on this issue? Do we know? No. Okay. Let me. If we could hear again from the proponents, if there's. Oh.
Sorry.
Okay. All right. I only have the council signed up on the sheet. Is there anybody else present that wanted to speak on the single subject issue of this one? Okay. All right. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the board. We believe that the single subject was properly set and that the title set by this board was not misleading and prejudicial. We have nothing more to add than what you have in the response that was filed with Mr. Ward yesterday, but we are certainly here and willing to answer any questions that the title board might have in response to either our response or the motions for rehearing that were filed by Mr. Gruskin or Mr. Legg.
Anybody have any questions?
Did you, and I know it was filed shortly before the hearing, have the chance to look at the response filed by Mr. Gruskin and the case law there and give us any clarity on whether you think that's a problem or relevant or irrelevant?
Briefly, I had a chance to look at it as I was walking over here, so I will address it on a limited basis. I do think that Mr. Gruskin is trying to throw out a red herring based on terminology in terms of using reapportionment and redistricting. Reapportionment, as you know, is the process by which Congress reallocates the number of districts per state after each census. Alternatively, redistricting, which is what this title has been set, which is the single subject purpose of this title, is different. It's the process of drawing both congressional and legislative boundaries. And that's the single subject that this title board set. I don't know a whole lot. I didn't get a chance to read the case in detail, but I do agree with the board that the legal authority that he did cite did not address single subject at all. It only cited constitutional severability, and constitutional severability is not the same thing as single subject. I believe that case related to severability of an amendment, and so I would say that I don't think that it's appropriate for the title board to consider that case in connection with the title that's been set.
Well, I'm flattered you consider my single views that of the board, but I would make clear that was just my question. Thank you.
Anything else? All right. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Why don't we take up the single subject portion of the rehearing first. Is there any discussion by the board? You want to start since?
I'm not inclined to overturn our past decision. I think in my mind, the perhaps inartfully put, the signal subject is drawing a lap out statewide election maps. But I would welcome the other members' views.
I think I'm in agreement. I'm very comfortable with our initial decision that this constitutes a single subject. In terms of the arguments in particular that Mr. Gruskin raised this morning regarding the 1975 decision, I agree, it's severability. It was only in the context of you had two conflicting constitutional amendments and the court was trying to determine whether or not the provision in Amendment 6 could be severed for purposes of determining which controlled if both those measures passed. I think the reference to a subject at that point in time was just that, a reference, a very loose reference to subject. It wasn't in terms of the single subject analysis or requirement that now exists. At the time back then, it did not exist. It was not a concern, obviously, by the content of the amendment number 6 that was involved. As Mr. Gruskin explained, it was a very broad measure that made very many changes to both the executive branch and legislative department. So I don't think that case law is helpful at all in that regard. I agree, you know, even though the Colorado Reapportionment Commission is called that, I agree that reapportionment in terms of the number of seats, whether congressional or legislative, is not something that the current commission deals with, and it's not something that the legislature deals with. And so what we're dealing with here is the drawing of boundaries for districts, whether they're congressional or legislative, and I believe that one commission doing those functions, that constitutes a single subject.
Do you want to make a motion?
I would move that we deny the motions for rehearing on the grounds of single subject. And then I guess we can go on to the other grounds raised in some of the motions. So I would just move that we deny the motions for rehearing on the grounds of single subject.
I second.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, that takes us back to the title. And Mr. Gruskin, did you want to offer anything new beyond what you filed in your motion?
I think the motion speaks for itself. Let me explain one or two items, if I might. The title talks about equal representation between major political parties. There's nothing in the measure that requires equal representation. And as a matter of fact, the measure is structured such that the person that is speaker and the person that is president appoint from their own political parties. Well, you have as proponents kind of an interesting case in point. Of course, Mr. McNulty was the speaker. Ms. Curry, former Representative Curry, was an unaffiliated member. Had in the election after Ms. Curry became an independent, had the legislature become a 32-32-1 legislature, who would have been the speaker? Well, very arguably, it might have been Ms. Curry, because, needless to say, the Democrats would not have ceded leadership to the Republicans and vice versa. So how does an unaffiliated person in legislative leadership appoint from his or her own party? The whole point is they're unaffiliated. They don't have a party. And so it is inherently presumptuous at bare minimum and incorrect, I would suggest, to say that the notion that you will have equal representation between major political parties is correct. And in fact, you may not even have appointing authority if you have a legislative leader who is, in fact, not affiliated with any party, because they cannot appoint under the measure. So your title, at least under some of the arguments that we have raised, specifically number 5 under the misleading and prejudicial, is inherently incorrect. It cannot be correct. It could by happenstance be correct, but as a matter of the structure of the measure, there is no guarantee. Likewise, for a measure that holds itself out to take politics out of the process, it seems to me that number 4 is important. It is inherently necessary to tell voters that this process whereby reapportionment will be given over to legislative members alone is, I think, a fairly central aspect and change from the existing system where you have the governor involved and the chief justice involved. The 4, after the legislative leaders appoint, there's a requirement that there be 4 members from the state's two largest parties. We ought to say that this measure is geared towards A, legislative involvement, and B, political party involvement, so that voters know what they're talking about. I think number 7 is a different flip on this issue, but by saying that even if you don't agree with me that you could have an unaffiliated person in legislative leadership, you have to, I think, inform voters that all these appointments are coming, at least the 8 legislative appointments are coming from members of leaders' own parties. And I think the other arguments are relatively, I tried to be concise. I think they are relatively self-explanatory, but I would point you to number 11, where you talk about existing congressional criteria. It seems to me that it is noteworthy that the courts have opined time and time and time again, a legislature setting congressional district boundaries doesn't have to have criteria. It may set political boundaries for whatever reason or lack of reason that it chooses. And therefore, this is somewhat of a misnomer. And the last issue that I think is really important, even though it is tucked into the measure, is the fact that it is the commission itself that sets the grounds for removal for cause of its members. In an inherently political process where the commission can unseat any member based upon its determination of what cause is, and more to the point, where 8 members can unseat any other member and shift the balance, you need to tell voters that this is not a commission. This is kind of all pieces of the same theme. This is not a commission that is going to be above politics. It is, in fact, structurally designed to be part of the political system and at least have the potential to be responsive to political pressures, that one being a notable one of them. Those are the issues I'd like to highlight on the list of issues I've given you.
Are there any questions from the board?
I do have a couple of questions. In regard to the appointments, in terms of the balance, and I'm trying to figure this out as well as you. When you're talking about the legislative appointments, where it talks about that no more than 4 members may be registered with the same party.
Right.
What do you think that language means? I mean, in terms of a limitation that 4 out of the 8 commission members that are appointed by the legislative leadership can only be from one or the other major political party, so that there is some balance?
I think that, yes, I think that you've accurately summarized what the measure does.
Okay. And then in terms of the members of the commission who are appointed that are not affiliated with a major political party, I think you make the argument that those appointments are also done by legislators. And I'm confused because the language that I'm seeing on page 5 of the draft or the measure talks about the highest ranking elected official who's a member of one of the state's two largest parties. And I mean, that doesn't say legislative, it just says elected official. So
I'm correct. But
in terms
of
your conclusion that it's a legislative appointment?
If you look at subparagraph C running from 5 to 6, it talks about the order of succession to the office of governor as provided in subsection 13 of Article 4, and that is the order of legislative leadership that would take office if the governor and the lieutenant governor either have resigned or have left their offices vacant. And
But Section 13 doesn't, it has an order of officials, and it talks about the governor first and then the lieutenant governor, and then gets into the matter of succession if there's a vacancy in both of those offices. And so, I mean, it just says following the order of officials. So those are legislative also. That's your argument.
That's what subsection 7 says, yes. And frankly, that was what was portrayed by proponents in their review and comment hearing. So the indication on the record and as to any legislative history is that it would be those officials rather than the governor and or the lieutenant governor somehow making appointments. And in any event, it would be somewhat anomalous if what they did in A and B, if your interpretation is right, is to give appointments under A to the governor and under B to the lieutenant governor. And it's certainly not their stated intent on the record at review and comment.
And so maybe if I could ask the proponents if they would, in terms of their take of this provision in your measure, as to what officials were talking about having the authority to appoint the commission members who are not affiliated with major political parties.
Thank you, Ms. Eubanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have been clear at every point during this process. The governor is the primary appointing authority here, and then the appointing authority that follows is the next highest ranking official according to that provision of the other major party makes the next series of appointments.
And so it has to be of the other political party or no? It's just of the two. So it could be the lieutenant governor.
It could be the lieutenant governor, sure.
Okay. Thank you.
And what do you think of Mr. Griskin's argument about the unaffiliated president of the Senate or Speaker of the House?
Well, I think I certainly would have voted for Representative Curry over Representative Carroll, but it could happen. It's possible that it would happen. And
but is that the point of the no more than four members shall be of
the initiative contemplates that happening by requiring that the balance be maintained regardless. We can't in an initiative or in statute, you cannot play out every potential action or every potential cause. What we can do is take the scenario that most often presents itself and attempt to build in safeguards to ensure that there is balance in the process. And in 107, we believe that we have done that.
We weren't there in the earlier hearings to witness the generation of legislative history. Can you comment on that? Did you make different statements before that mean that the statute operates differently than as you've just described it?
Thank you, Mr. Yarger. On initiative 107?
Yeah, on the appointment process.
No, I believe that we've been clear throughout this process, and certainly if either myself or Representative Curry had made a statement to the contrary, it was accidental. Our intent all along was to send the next series of appointments to the governor and then to move through the line of succession in order to ensure that there continues to be balance on the commission, because that's the way that we get a truly transparent process, a truly competitive process, and one that is beholden to the people and not to politicians or well-heeled lawyers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Legg, did you have anything that you wanted to add on the question?
For the most part, the motion can speak for itself. I would just emphasize two issues that we took with the title that was set, the use of the term renaming in the second line of the title. That's where the title leads off in describing the initiative, and we think it's a material underselling of the changes that it then itemizes going forward. And we think that giving the voters a first impression by using the word renaming when such substantial changes are actually done to the existing commission causes confusion. And there's also some ambiguity, I think, that the voters would face in reading the rest of the initiative. If they can delineate that what are changes, in fact, to the existing commission are changes as opposed to new standards for the newly created commission handling congressional redistricting. And that's another reason we think that if you chose a different word rather than renaming, it would be a more honest description and more informative to the voters. And secondly, we took issue with the use of the term affiliated. We recognize the legal meaning of that term, and you're targeting that they can't be registered with the same party. But we think that voters are going to see that term and kind of read the general understanding, a layman's perspective of what affiliated means. And then from there, the motion gets into more detail why we don't think that that's accurate based on a layperson's understanding of that term, on the average voter's understanding of that term. And I don't need to get into that. The motion speaks to itself. But someone who's picked for a job by somebody else, a layperson would certainly think that that person is affiliated with the person who picked them for that job. But if there's no questions from there.
If I could.
Sure.
In terms of that issue, if you object to that terminology, what terminology would you use?
You could be literal, not be registered with. I don't think it would add much.
Well, they are still a registered elector or registered voter.
With the party, with the same party.
Well, but you don't register with a party. You register to vote. You affiliate or not affiliate with a party. At least, perhaps that's my understanding. Perhaps the election.
It might create more work than that I haven't thought of. But that kind of legal jargon. I mean, you've stumped me with it. So you're going to see with a layperson, they're not going to read affiliated to know that that's distinguished from registering with the party or being affiliated with the major party. So I'm not sure what the right word is, but I would say, you know, that's a case in point right there that affiliate is not the right one. That's got a loaded legal definition that voters aren't going to follow.
Mr. Gruskin?
Could I just jump in on this? It's important for you to know that the measure does not require members of the commission to be registered voters, just to the contrary. On page 6, it retains the existing language that commission members must be qualified electors, not registered electors. Qualified meaning, obviously, that you meet the prerequisites for voting. But qualified electors, and the case law is rich on this issue, is a different criterion than being a registered voter. And this is Mr. Legg's motion, but I just wanted to bring that clarity to the...
But how would you be affiliated if you weren't?
Right. I mean, don't you read the provisions together to suggest that you must either be affiliated or unaffiliated?
Well,
you're affiliated, I believe you have to be registered.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you... I agree qualified is different than registered, but when they're together, qualified and affiliated...
But the term of art is qualified elector. It's not affiliated. So you could be a qualified elector, somebody who hasn't registered, who has leanings and past activities on behalf of candidates for whom you have not actually voted. I understand the nature of the word affiliated, and but for the retention of...
Let me ask you this. Do you agree that you can be appointed by a member of a major political party and yet be unaffiliated? Because it seems to me the substance of the criticism by Mr. Legg is that if you're appointed by a member of a major political party, in fact, you will not be free or unbeholden to that party. You will be beholden to your appointer. And I think the point of this measure is simply to state a criteria that members appointed under this subsection C may not be or have been affiliated for a period of one calendar year prior to their appointment with the same political party of any member already appointed to the commission.
I guess my sole purpose here, because this isn't part of my motion, is to point out that this measure is crafted in a way that it leaves that issue open. And yes, I think I actually think that the one of the issues, there are ceilings on how many people can be affiliated with any party. But as to the unaffiliated voters, it seems to me they are not subject to that ceiling. So that means they are also not subject to the requirement that they be registered to vote, only that they identify with a particular party in the way that would be precluded by the measure.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Legg, in initiative number 38, we use the term renaming. I mean, do you think that there was some difference between what was going on in that initiative and what's going on in this initiative that would cause us to have to change the way we worded it?
Yes, Madam Chairperson. I think that the changes are much more substantial here.
Okay.
Much more substantial.
All right, thanks. Do the proponents want to say anything about the comments on the language of the measure?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did respond in our the motion, the response that we filed. We support the title board's findings in front of us here, and we do not believe that the title that we have is misleading or prejudicial, that it is in plain language, and that it is easy for voters to understand once this makes the ballot, once they make the decision after reading their blue book. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right.
I'll start the discussion. I think most of the concerns raised by the objectors relate to the third clause in the trailer, which are reflected on lines 4 and 5. I think we tried hard to be concise, but reflect how appointment works without going into unnecessary detail. On the issue of registered versus qualified electors and affiliated, not affiliated, it might perhaps be true that the effect of this measure means that certain members of the commission must both be registered electors affiliated with a party, and others may be non-registered but qualified electors that are not affiliated with a party. But I think our concern in setting the title was capturing generally how the process was supposed to work, which I believe is setting a certain number of members of the commission that are affiliated with the party and those that are not, to ensure a certain, I don't want to use the word balanced, but a certain mix of people on the commission, and that's not qualitative, it's not good or bad, it's just trying to reflect what this initiated measure does. I think some of the other objections to the title, I think we tried hard to address all major portions of this measure. I think we were successful in doing so. We did debate last time this idea of existing criteria and whether they come from statute or case law or apply to commissions or legislators or judges. And I think we decided that just making clear that there are criteria and this commission must use them was adequate for us and for these purposes. I think some of these other title objections are perhaps built on differing interpretations. I've satisfied myself that we understand what the plain language of the measure does, and I think what it is sort of intended to do, and so I'm satisfied with the title.
Ms. Curry, did you want to add something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment briefly on the use of the terminology, those not affiliated with any major party. Colorado is one of the few states where when you go in to register to vote, the county clerk explains to you that you can't register independent. We get to be called unaffiliated. And the registered voters are, as a rule, educated by the county clerk with regard to that status. And anybody who does not affiliate with a major or minor party is quite familiar with the terminology because they're going to get it explained to them by the county clerk, since they typically want to call themselves independent, but you can't in Colorado. So I just feel that the voters are going to be well equipped to understand that language.
I thought about whether we should be more specific in talking about the makeup of the commission and the appointment process, but I think we struggled with that last time, and I think once you get into it, if we really said, 12 members and here's where we start and here's the end formula, I think we captured it pretty well with the major components of it that I think the voters would be concerned with, which is quite frankly, probably not who makes the appointments as much as what ends up happening as a result and who ends up being on the commission. I think it's pretty clear that because we're using balancing those not affiliated with the major parties, that it's certainly driven by politics. I don't think that that's hidden in the question. And I'm satisfied with what we've done in the last one.
In terms of the title that we set and some of the arguments that have been raised, I don't know, and I don't think we can figure it out. I mean, we can rely on the proponent statements. We can agree with Mr. Gruskin's arguments in terms of who is going to make some of the appointments, in particular with a reference to subsection 7 of section 13. It refers to, the first thing it does, it refers to the officers of both the governor and the lieutenant governor. Is that the order of officials pursuant to subsection 7, perhaps? Perhaps it is, as Mr. Gruskin argues, later on, the legislative officers that would succeed if both the office of governor and lieutenant governor are vacant, if they're of the same political party, and then if they're not. I mean, it's a very convoluted process. I don't know which way it is. I don't know that we can figure that out or that that's even our job, but because there may be arguments on both sides in terms of how that requirement is going to be interpreted, I don't think we go there now. I don't think that I can say with any certainty that all of the appointments are made by legislative members. I don't know one way or the other. And so I'm comfortable with talking about, as the title does, the appointment of members without getting into who actually is appointing them. In terms of Mr. Gruskin's argument of an unaffiliated member of the legislature being leadership, it's possible. It hasn't happened, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. Whether or not it would be as a solution to the issue if we were to remove the word equal from that phrase of the title, so that we just talk about that there is the appointment of members with representation from each major political party and those not affiliated with any major party, at least in terms of the possibility, how that all would play out. I think that to remove that word would still be an accurate statement of what the measure does. And so I would be open to that. I don't know if the other title board members would be agreeable. And in terms of the arguments about existing criteria versus it's all new, I think we had that discussion before that in terms of case law, criteria that's been established by case law is being pulled into the Constitution. So I do believe that it's existing for both congressional and legislative districts. So I don't have a concern with the title as it's drafted right now. And if need be, on the last phrase, if that's somehow ambiguous, whether or not we want to just say that the commission's subject to the public meetings law and get away from, you know, what is the commission's work and what is a public meeting and all of that, we could change that easily enough to take care of that concern. But those are the only, the removal of equal is probably the only one that I feel more strongly about, that by, I think removing that term is still, would still have an accurate statement in the title as to what the measure requires in terms of the appointments.
Do you have any comment on the equal?
I'd be open to discussing that more. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I think I would have to understand better what the arguments are about how the two provisions B and C interact to possibly create a, quote, unequal commission. But perhaps equal is simply just not something we need to say. We can just say requiring appointment of members with representative from each major political party and those not affiliated. Is that what you were thinking, Sharon?
Yeah.
I think the problem with that has been you can get the sense or that, I mean, most people associate major political party with Democrat and Republican. And I know we had that discussion last time that we had a major political party in Colorado that, you know, was not Democrat or the Republicans. And so I suppose if you wanted to explain every single scenario, that could happen, right? But if you leave out the word equal representation, then people really don't know much of anything about the appointment process. And they can get the impression that maybe we're going to get, I mean, we don't even state a number in here, so maybe I'm going to have, you know, 12 Republicans and one Democrat. I don't like it. I mean, I suppose the solution is you have to go read the blue book, but, or you have to go read the initiative itself. So I kind of liked the word equal, even though I understand it might not. Always be 100% accurate. I don't know. I thought it was at least descriptive. Did you want to comment?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate the suggestion. I think for the voters that read that, if we don't have a word, a qualifying word there, perhaps balanced would work, because that was the goal of our initiative, was to balance the commission. But if we take the word out and we don't give them any descriptive terms, I think one might get the impression that it is out of balance, and that was not our intent.
And I guess my problem is I'm not sure what the balance is. I find balance, the word balanced, as problematic as equal. I mean, just because it says no more than four members may be registered with the same major political party doesn't mean, I mean, it's sort of going along with Mr. Gruskin's argument, if you were to have a member of legislative leadership who was libertarian, then this says that they have to appoint a person from their political party. And so at least the possibility exists. I don't know that it's always going to be balanced in terms of how we view things right now, in terms of there could be four Republicans, four Democrats, and four that were not affiliated with any political party or with a minor political party. I don't know that that's always, that this measure as it's drafted always has that result. And so I'm concerned that including that terminology is not accurate. It's a misrepresentation of what the measure provides. And so while it may, to have a term like that, I totally understand that that may be helpful to the voters, but if it's not accurate, then I don't believe it should be in there.
Well, I was thinking the other thing we could do is instead of toying with the word equal, we could toy with the word requiring, instead just setting procedures to, I mean, I don't know how you know, so it's not quite as strong that, you know, to signal that it may not always happen this way, but there are procedures to equalize representation. Equalize the appointment or something like that. I don't know.
And I'm not sure.
The same issues.
Yeah. I don't know that that satisfies my concerns. I mean, I might have concerns if we go that direction. We can pursue that if you wish. Mm-hmm.
Just...
I wonder if we could say something like providing for appointment of a member such that no major political party or shall have a majority on the commission. I mean, I think that's the point of this measure.
I don't know if it's the point of the measure, but it's what it does.
Well, excuse me, it's what, I believe that's what the language does. Do the proponents have any?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Yarger. We believe that the language the title board set accurately represents not only our intent, but the plain language of the initiative. We also think that that the way the title is constructed, it is in plain language so that voters can understand and get an idea of what's happening here. The initiative itself, which will be available to the voter, if they choose to move through and see exactly how this appointment process plays out, the purpose of the title is to inform the voter generally and in plain language what's happening with the initiative and give them an idea on what they're voting. The title as it was set does that. We can't be, just like we can't be prescriptive of every potential scenario in the initiative itself or in any statute for that matter, the title does not allow us to be as prescriptive in every portion of the initiative. That's what the blue book is for. That's why that information is available to the voter. And we hope that they take advantage of that, and many do. But the title as it was set is clear, relatively concise, and provides voters with a clear picture of what the initiative is doing.
So do you object to the amendment then? Do you dislike that amendment?
In my opinion, having an affirmative statement is more clear to the voters than having a statement in the negative that no major political party shall have a majority on the commission, but rather the affirmative statement of equal representation is more clear to the voter.
But don't you agree there are scenarios where that's not true?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely, and I agree with you. I understand the language, I think. But it is possible, isn't it, that you'd have two libertarians, two Democrats, four Republicans, and then four unaffiliateds?
There are different scenarios that can play out.
And the language that we had there before was requiring appointment of members with equal representation from each major political party, currently Republicans and Democrats, and those not affiliated. What that says is it will always be the case that there will be four Democrats, four Republicans, and four who are either unaffiliated, libertarian, green, whatever.
Well, not even that. It could be if you're saying each represent equal representation from each major political party and you had four major political parties, then you have scenarios that could happen. I mean, I guess the problem is your choice, it seems, is to take out the word equal. And really then the voters are being told nothing. Because I think at this point the board feels like the word equal is a misrepresentation of what could happen. So then you're left with, you know, this statement that there's going to be appointments. Well, that's really informative and fascinating. Or you're left with trying to describe it in a way that's accurate. And you're right, we're not going to capture the whole thing because we can't even figure out what that flow chart looks like. But so I guess the question is, what would you like more, this language or strike the equal?
Thank you for bringing crystal clarity to it, Madam Chair. if those are the two options that the board is considering, then we think the amendment is more descriptive than simply striking the word equal.
And how do you feel about the language?
I might suggest a different way, a different approach to it if we go down this road. And that's because I feel that the fact that there are four appointments that have to be individuals who are not affiliated with major political parties, because to me, I think that's an important factor. And whether or not so, and it, because right now, as it's been proposed, by just saying that no major political party shall have a majority on the commission doesn't really indicate that there would be folks not affiliated with a major political party. So whether a different way of going about it would be requiring appointment of members so that not more than four are from the same, are affiliated with the same major political party, and at least four are not affiliated with any, I mean, to at least you have that limitation on major political party, but you also have an indication that there are individuals on the commission that are not affiliated with a major political party.
Yeah. I think you have to say then requiring appointment of 12 members, or else
I would,
telling people there's four doesn't mean.
I would just remove the word major from the amendment that I suggested, and here's why. Nowhere in B or C does it mention major political party, I don't think. And so those appointed by the legislative leadership could be of major parties, or they could be of minor parties, as unlikely as that could be. Subsection C says that those who are appointed there could be from a major party. It's just that they can't be of the party of those appointed under subsection B. I think the way this works in practice is that it will always be true that this commission, however constituted, will not be a majority of a particular political party or a majority of unaffiliated. So I personally think the best way to capture that notion in the operational language is requiring appointment of members such that no political party shall have a majority on the commission.
I agree, though, that that can imply, I mean, that doesn't draw the voters to the fact that there will be unaffiliated people on the.
There may or may not be. They don't have to be unaffiliated. They must be unaffiliated with the party of those party. Appointed under the previous subsection.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The public policy goal is to ensure that under our, the way in which we currently do things, that neither major political party can control the process through its appointments. That normal people who are not affiliated with any political party have true and valuable input into the drawing of these, the districts to elect the people who represent them in the state capitol, and the people who represent them in the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. So to the extent that we can recognize that significant portion of Colorado's voting public and give them some indication that their voice will be included and valued in this commission, I think that that would be helpful. And I think, Ms. Eubanks, that was your suggestion, and
right.
We would appreciate an accommodation along those lines in the title.
Let me take a stab.
Sure.
So you can see. Okay. So let's remove the proposed language on lines 4 and 5. And I agree with the suggestion that perhaps the number of members might be helpful when then we're talking about no more than four. So so why don't we say appointment of 12 members. With, and then strike equal representation. And insert no more than four members. And then strike each before major and put in the same and then further on that line strike those and insert at least 4 members I think that reads okay.
Well, and I think then all the other scenarios can still exist under this language because we have the at least and we're not prescribing a certain mandatory formula.
Sorry, I'm just checking the terminology. In terms of the issue that Mr. Yeager brought up about of the 8, that provision doesn't really refer to major political party and whether we should just say from the same political party. But then I think the other appointments... say that they're not affiliated, they're registered with minor or who are unaffiliated, which I think then the default is that they're not affiliated with a major political party. And so perhaps they're on line 5, we want to strike major before political. That's my staff edit.
Mr. Gruskin or Mr. Legg, do you have any comment on whether you think that's accurate under the measure? Are you guys still around? Oh, yeah. You don't know?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I don't know.
That's a fundamental problem. I do think that line 6, all sub C on page 5 requires...
Oh, sorry.
Now we don't have the part on the record where you said you have no idea.
You can turn yours off. All sub C says is that these other 4 not be affiliated with anyone who's got a party affiliation who's already on the commission. So the proposal that there might be a couple libertarians appointed by a libertarian leader would not be accurate. Because actually, I mean, the struggle for how you would find people is obvious, but it isn't necessarily true that if you had the commission of 4 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and 2 Green Party, that the remaining 4 members couldn't be affiliated with any of those 3 parties, not just any major party. So you're not, I hate to say you're not there yet. I'd be happy to help, but it's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, I don't think it's mind-boggling. I think, and I appreciate that. I think I agree with you. I do think that the easiest way to do this is to say with, going back to the old language, no party shall constitute a majority of the commission. I suppose the concern was that it doesn't mention unaffiliateds, but I don't think this mechanically does that. So that's my concern. I'm still trying to digest the language up there and see if it actually is accurate as a logical matter. I mean, it is true. It will, I believe, be true that at least 4 members will not be affiliated with any major party. I don't think it's possible for the appointments to work out otherwise. And so I think strictly, I do believe this is accurate. So if that's the way the board wants to go, I don't necessarily object to that, and I do think it is accurate.
I mean, I think I agree, Mr. Gruskin, it doesn't explain every scenario, but I do think that those other 4 members can't be affiliated because they can't be the same as the other board members, right? So.
Right. I understand the board's position.
Yeah. Do the proponents agree with the current language? Because it seems like that's the consensus we're starting to lean toward.
Madam Chair, we are comfortable with the amended language that is reflected on the screen. Even though the fact that Mr. Gruskin sat down so quickly leaves me with a, some level of discomfort, but
right. I knew he would be mapping it out in his head.
I don't think we're the last stop on this.
I suspect you're not, and I suspect that's why you got a memo at 7:30 this morning. But we are comfortable with the language that you have in front of you.
Well, my concern is that this is, whether perfect or not, accurate.
Yeah.
And I believe it is accurate. I believe that the measure does require appointment of 12 members. I think with that much, everybody can agree. I think it's true no more than 4 members can be from any particular party. And I think it's true always, even if all of the folks are minor party candidates and we just have a great proliferation of them sometime in the future, at least 4 will not be affiliated with any major political party. I think that will always be true. So I think this reflects the thrust of the measure, which is to, again, I don't like the term, but to create some balance on the commission. And I think it's accurate, so I am okay with the language.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, for the board's purposes, I'm not quibbling with this language because I plan on taking it to the Supreme Court. If I thought there was a flaw, I would tell you. I think that this language is accurate, and I think, insofar as it goes, it represents the measure substantively, and just for purposes of the board. This is not a setup, and this...
Don't misunderstand me. I don't...
I know. But Mr. McNulty, with whom I have a good joking relationship, thought that I might be luring you. And I'm just telling you that I think that this is accurate, and this wouldn't be something that my client would object to at the Supreme Court, because it is reflective of the measure.
Understood. Thank you. I appreciate that. And certainly we aren't offended or in any way put off if people do disagree with us and want to take it one step further.
And I just asked because I knew you would be thinking about it in your mind, so I wasn't trying to commit you. All right.
So I would move the language on lines 4 and 5.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm going to read the – do you have something else to add?
I'll just say thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Mr. Ward, thank you for your time.
I'm going to read it into the record, and then we can do a motion. It's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning redistricting in Colorado and in connection therewith, renaming the Colorado Reapportionment Commission as the Colorado Redistricting Commission, directing that the commission redistrict congressional districts as well as legislative districts, requiring appointment of 12 members with no more than 4 members from the same political party and at least 4 members not affiliated with any major party, prohibiting commission members from being lobbyists or incumbent members or candidates for either the state legislature or Congress, adopting existing criteria for congressional districts and adding competitiveness to the criteria for state legislative and congressional districts, requiring that only the nonpartisan staff of the commission may submit plans to the commission, and requiring that the commission's work be done in public meetings.
Okay, so I think the motion needs to be that we deny the motions for rehearing on grounds other than single subject and other than to the extent we've modified the title, that we deny those motions for rehearing.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Right. I mean, we could have been more charitable and said we grant to the extent. Oh, but I suppose.
Consider that for the next.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, that takes us to, unless anyone needs a recess.
Yeah?
No, I'm okay for now.
That takes us to proposed initiative 2015-2016, number 100. And if the proponents could come forward and introduce themselves.
Hello.
Hi. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
My name is Lance Wright.
Okay, and for the record, is the other proponent present?
Yes.
Okay. And you want to just start out by telling us what you believe the single subject of your initiative is?
We are affirming the right of a mentally competent adult to receive help in achieving a peaceful death via the administration of a medical protocol.
And does anybody have any questions for the proponents on the single subject? Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on the issue of single subject of this initiative? Okay.
I do.
Okay.
In opposition.
Of the single subject?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then we need to get you on the microphone.
We have one. I have a handheld.
Okay. Oh. So you can just stay where you are and he'll bring you a...
Okay.
Great. Thanks. All right. If you can just state your name.
My name is Carrie Ann Lucas. I'm here on behalf of myself and also Colorado Not Dead Yet, a grassroots organization of Colorado voters. And we don't believe that the single subject as stated by Mr. Wright is indicative of the single subject. I don't think it is a single subject. He's asking to do a number of things in his initiative, including enabling frank euthanasia, non-voluntary euthanasia in his proposal, creates a number of different legislative definitions within his proposal, and it does violate the single subject requirements of the Colorado Constitution.
Okay. Any questions about for this opponent? Anybody else who wishes to testify in opposition? I think, Stephen, should we go back to the, you want to do the handheld, or are they both working at the same time?
They both work.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Evan Hyatt, and I, too, am in opposition of the single subject for a number of reasons. Do you want me to read those now? Or?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. I think, too, it tries to do many things other than what is described. One, altering the definition of inalienable rights, as stated in both the Bill of Rights and the Colorado Constitutions. The rights would now include the right to set the time and tone of their own death by obtaining a medical professional's assistance in achieving a peaceful death through the careful administration of a medical protocol. I believe it also sets up a new class of citizens, now called citizen sovereigns. Thirdly, it grants complete immunity to anyone assisting in the death if they produce a document supporting the claim for the request for and rendering of this assistant, yet the document is not required in the amendment. Also, it sets up different set of rules for conditional time deferred medical aid in dying in Section 5, differing from the medical aid in dying that is described in Section 4 of the initiative. Medical protocol used in Section 4 is undefined in the initiative and leave it open to vast interpretations. Many things could be described as medical protocol. Sixthly, the definition of citizen sovereign can be construed to be used in many, many issues. The measure is incapable of being contained within the single title. And lastly, no matter what the title assigned to the initiative, there will be arguments that is misleading or biased.
Okay. Any questions? No? All right. Anyone else?
Oops. Sorry about that. Sorry.
Thank you. Good morning, members. My name is Amy Cardone. I'm with the law firm of Martin Conklin. I'm here today on behalf of the Colorado Medical Society as our outside legal counsel. I would like to just elaborate on a couple of the comments regarding the lack of single subject as stated by the previous speakers. Most particularly, the Colorado Medical Society submits that the board does lack jurisdiction to set title at this time for two primary reasons. The first is that Initiative 100 would expand the definition of inalienable rights as set forth in Article 2, Section 2 of the Colorado Constitution. That article states that all persons have certain natural, essential, and inalienable rights. Initiative 100 at proposed Section 28A1A grafts onto the Colorado Constitution language regarding inalienable rights such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that are actually derived from the Declaration of Independence. Additionally, proposed Section 28A3 includes a new right of, quote, self-determination that is vague and I submit extremely broad, would encompass matters well beyond just choices related to personal medical decisions. Also, as referenced by the previous speaker, Initiative 100 creates a new class of, quote, citizen sovereigns. That is defined within the initiative as mentally competent adults who are lawful residents of the United States. This new class of individuals would alter the Colorado Constitution in two respects. The first is that Article 2, Section 1, which again provides that all government is instituted solely for the good of the whole. And it also would alter Article 2, Section 3, which states all persons have certain inalienable rights. Again, the emphasis on all persons. This new class of citizen sovereigns, as defined in the initiative, would limit constitutional rights, this new constitutional right, to less than the whole as provided in Article 2, Section 1, and would not apply to all persons as set forth in Article 2, Section 3. In sum, the initiative would grant constitutional rights to only those who fall within the definition of a mentally competent adults who are lawful residents of the United States, and constitutional rights have never turned on either citizens or indeed mental competency. So for those reasons, we submit that the board lacks jurisdiction.
Anybody else, any questions? No. Anybody else who wishes to speak on the single subject? And the proponents want to respond at all?
Yes, thank you. Had somewhat of a familiar ring to it. I have a document I want to pass out for your perusal that addresses many of the points made by the previous opponents. And one of the first things I want to say is that the concern about creating new rights and new classifications of people actually are in the section of our proposal that I think is accurately described as a finding. It's not declaring that we're making a particular law. It's just the observation that we have about the situation that exists in the state of Colorado today. And
the so information, if you're not intending it to be somehow legally binding, why do you have it in here?
Mainly it's in there to show why it's necessary. The idea of a heart-lung machine or a triple bypass surgery didn't exist 100 to 200 years ago when the country and the state were founded. But the idea that the citizen was the sovereign is something that was determined at that time, saying that what wasn't delegated to some other part of the government was retained by the individual. And with that handout, have you all received the handout that I just passed out? I think the bottom quote there is, sovereignty resides in individuals the individual and not the state is the source and basis of our social compact, and that sovereignty now resides and has always resided in the individual, is a consideration that would seem to indicate that this is not some new radical idea that we're proposing. The other point that I would like to make is that the this section where we're concerned about the medical society folks are concerned about interfering with their abilities. Again, we have some precedent for that, and if you would like, I would just cite the medical marijuana law provided for the physicians to be able to participate under the strictures of that particular law and not be subject to other penalties that they would have otherwise. And another law that provided immunity for actions that were otherwise illegal was the Colorado Make My Day law. So I don't think that we're, again, doing anything new and unusual. What we're trying to do is the citizen has the right to control their own destiny. If they get help, they can do that. And to have the people that help them be immune from any sort of sanction is what the single purpose of this this proposed amendment is.
Any questions? No. All right. No. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any discussion?
I believe that the measure constitutes a single subject. I'm willing to make a motion to proceed to set a title, but the other title board members didn't agree the last time that this measure was before us, so I won't make the motion until I get a better feel for the other board members. Position.
But excuse me, I might mention that a couple of the offending phrases that I know Madam Chairman was particularly concerned about were removed, just to try to clarify that we're talking about
right.
Medical.
And I noted that, and I'm satisfied at this point that it constitutes a single subject. I mean, we commonly struggle with these declarations and what they mean and what they do, and why they're there, but I mean, at this point, I don't think they have any legal effect, and so I'm satisfied that it constitutes a single subject.
I agree. I think the concerning provision mostly is section 1, subsection 1A. But I think it just states that there are certain documents that say certain things. And I think it would be up to interpreting courts to determine whether those documents in fact say that and what the effect of that language might mean. I think the rest of this sort of findings clause section or prefatory section isn't really phrased in terms of substantive provisions that will apply in certain circumstances. It's just stating that Coloradans are surprised to learn certain things and that science has advanced, and then it goes on to describe later in later subsections how the substantive provisions of this measure would actually operate. So I agree with Madam Chair that this this prefatory clause is it's there. I'm not quite sure what it does, but I think the measure all relates to the single subject of attaining assistance from medical professionals to assist with dying, as the staff draft says. So I agree with the single subject determination.
Then I would go ahead and move that the board find that proposed initiative 2015-16 number 100 constitutes a single subject and that we proceed to set a title.
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay.
So I'm going
to move to the title. Do you have, the proponents have any comments on the staff draft title?
No, it's fine with us.
I know we had a number of people comment on single subject, and some of those comments kind of went into the title. Is there anybody who wishes to talk specifically about the language of the staff draft?
Okay. I will, but I actually don't have the. I need to get a copy.
Yeah, here, we'll grab you one off the table.
Sorry, I couldn't get it.
She's got it.
And I don't know if the other opponents had other comments.
Any other proponents have other comments on the staff draft?
I'm sure you're still on here. You're with Tom.
And that's the draft that's up on the screen there to your left also.
My primary concern is with the terminology medical aid and dying. It's very misleading. It doesn't refer to what this initiative proposes. This initiative proposes a physician prescribed death, a lethal prescription, as opposed to medical aid and dying, which can be any number of things, including palliative care and hospice care. So for that perspective, we think it's very, that the title and that use of terminology is very misleading. In fact, we have two different proposals before the title board today that both use that same terminology that do vastly different things. And I think that this one, I think it's also the title as set does not reference the non-voluntary portion. This allows this to happen without regard to the competency of the individual who is utilizing or the assistance needed at the time that somebody is using this lethal prescription. So that's a concern that's not in the title. This initiative would allow somebody to involuntarily give this to another individual without their express authorization, and that's not included in this title.
Okay. All right, any questions?
In terms of that particular concern, that in terms of sort of the non-voluntary operation, what provisions of the measure deal with that? I mean, I read that there's the ability to terminate such an agreement, and even when you have a situation where they're no longer competent, that the agreement can, I mean, the person willingly agreed, went into the agreement. So I'm, in terms of what provisions of the measure deal with this sort of non-voluntary operation?
In part because of there's the immunity portions are so broad in this proposal, but also in this, it's in terms of it's really saying there's no definition of what mentally competent is or any time frame for when somebody had to be mentally competent. There's no provision saying that somebody at the time they're exercising this has to be mentally competent. So somebody could be mentally competent at age 18, but then acquire a brain injury or some sort of dementia, and somebody else could procure this lethal prescription on their behalf under this proposal and give it to them decades in the future. There's nothing limiting when, if somebody made a request and filled out, say, a living will or some sort of end-of-life advance directive as a young adult or even as a middle-aged adult and life circumstances change, there's nothing in this initiative that would prevent them from having that lethal prescription not be dispensed based upon that earlier medical, document. And so and the title as proposed does not indicate that.
Okay, thank you.
Could I comment on that?
Sure.
The drafting, I think, is relatively clear that this entire process is voluntary. The idea that agreement can be made to receive a lethal injection in the future is strictly voluntary. And it's voluntary on the part of the physician, the medical professional that entered into the agreement. And we even have the provision in there that they, of course, have to make some arrangements to understand how they would resolve disavowing the agreement. The involuntary nature that has been warned about, I think, is not actually in the document. It's in someplace else other than anything that we're proposing. If you look at a medical order for treatment, MOLST and POLST, those are agreements that are made to have something done in the future, and they're voluntary. And that's what this is patterned after, but it's not spelled out. This is a constitutional amendment. I tried to avoid micromanaging any sorts of details that would get us bogged down like we were in the previous discussion that you folks just got through, going through with the potential of what about this, what about that, what about that. It's voluntary on the part of the person wanting medical aid in dying, and it's voluntary on the part of the person providing the rendering of the medical aid in dying.
Thank you. So it seems to me that criticism might be addressed by the later language in the title that discusses the agreements. I wonder if you could speak to the term medical aid in dying explain why you think that's an appropriate term to use in the title provision, and whether there are other formulations that would be equally accurate, because that was another objection raised.
Well, for one, it's basically a description of what we're referring to. Medical aid in dying is a terminology that is used in this field. It, up until this particular proposal, it meant a person who wished to have a peaceful death securing a prescription that they had to self-administer. This allows for someone with advancing dementia to make an arrangement while they're still rational, and then to have it administered to them following their desires at some future date. And we refer to it as a medical protocol because, again, we didn't want to micromanage. Right now, the state of medical technology is that you can take your pills and that will work, or you can have an injection that might work. But I remember when I was a kid, I got a polio vaccine by squirting a pressurized needleless vaccine in my arm. There may be some other technique where they put a compress on your forehead. And,
right, but I think her objection is that by putting that in the single subject, let's see if I can articulate it somewhat. There are a lot of other things that people can consider medical aid in dying. I mean, do you agree that hospice care could be medical aid in dying? I mean, you are at a hospice to have a peaceful death, and although they are not facilitating that through a prescription or something like that, you are still being provided medical aid in the process of dying. So I think the objection is that you are using a term that is much more broad and probably processes that are perhaps much more accepted. So if somebody reads this and they say, oh, I think we should have a medical we should have a right to medical aid while we are dying. That's much different than potentially what you're describing in this initiative, which is something very specific, right? It's not this broad, you know, home health care, hospice, all these other things that can happen that you receive medical aid for.
I guess I don't understand how we would be impacting the existing procedures.
Well, you're not. You're not. But the point is you're using a term that a normal, ordinary person could perceive to encompass all of those things. So that may not be what you're doing in your initiative, but by using that term, I think she's almost saying that term is a bit of a catchphrase. You know, medical aid in dying, it implies that maybe there's not a right to do all these things that we already have a right to, which is, you know, a hospice and the pain relief and those kinds of things that can occur in that process. So I think the question is, should that be a different term? Should this be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution for, you know, assisted suicide, I mean, whatever you want to call it, for a lethal prescription, you know, something more technical than what we have up there, which is medical aid in dying.
I wouldn't object if we want to try to work something out. The point is that the individual has the right to take their matters into their own hands, whether that's hospice or whether it's starving yourself to death or whether it's refusing medical treatment. That all exists independent of this, and we're just making sure that it takes the last freedom that's denied us and allows it to take place with help, and those folks aren't liable for some sort of criminal charge.
Understood. Is there a more concise phraseology that you might suggest, aside from medical aid and dying, that we might use there in its place?
Hello, this is Mercedes Aponte. I would ask the opponent to suggest something if she feels there might be a different phraseology. I'd be open to hear that.
Do you have something? And what we're talking about really is the single subject. So that's the top line you see. Right. We have, you know, a single subject. And then in the trailer, we put a lot of the other things that you talked about.
Right. It should either say prescription, physician prescribed death, or doctor prescribed suicide.
Okay. I would object to suicide because that's a whole different definition. But for perhaps physician-assisted medical aid in dying?
Well, then you're back to the whole, that could be hospice, that could be home health care, that could be
physician. It has been in other jurisdictions, they have used physician aid in dying or physician-aided.
In a ballot question or in a law?
In other laws.
Yeah, I mean, you can, this is about informing the voters of what they're, I mean, this isn't about what you wrote in here, this is about the voters understanding what they're voting on.
I would suggest perhaps.
What about her first one? What was it, physician?
Physician prescribed death.
I would suggest physician assisted death, because we are referring to people who are already have an incurable and possibly terminal illness, not anyone else in this particular.
But prescribed sounds more like there's a more active part on a more active role on the part of the medical professional, and I don't think that that's what we're trying to accomplish. What we're trying to accomplish is that the citizen gets to do what they want to do, and the doctor either agrees or doesn't agree and doesn't do it.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
If I could just make one more comment. Sure. I would say that that's exactly what they're asking for, is the doctor to prescribe a lethal prescription. So, and that's what's different from what's what happens now. They're asking that a doctor be able to prescribe a lethal prescription, and that's what should be in the title.
Yeah, I think his concern is that he's looking at the word prescribe maybe a little more broadly than the, you know, written prescription, as though this is a doctor's sort of medical plan for you. So prescribe in a broader, I mean, I agree with you that there ultimately is a, you know, prescription for a drug, but that perhaps using that term.
I'm not aware of any anyone using the term physician-assisted death by starvation, or physician-assisted physician prescription for withholding medication to bring about death,
right?
Which is perfectly acceptable now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
If I could just say one thing on that last comment, the right, every individual as affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, has a right to deny treatment. That's what he's referring to. Everyone has the right to deny treatment. This is not about denying treatment. This is about asking a doctor to prescribe a lethal prescription.
Correct. It's also voluntary on both parties' parts. So the doctor can refuse that.
Right, but that's not about what the top line is. I mean, that we get into that later. But.
Right, right.
Well, thank you. I understand. I think the sort of the tension and the difficulty here. I would just suggest that, and again, we're only dealing with this initial language, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning physician-assisted death.
Yeah.
And I suggest that because I understand the notion of a prescription, but if you read the definitions here, it talks about application of a medical protocol that is lethal. And I think physician-assisted death is broad enough perhaps to describe that. I'm not expert enough to know the difference between a particular medical protocol and a particular drug regimen or a particular absence of one, and I want to be careful not to be too too narrow, but also not too broad here. So that's my starting point, at least, and I'm certainly open to other thoughts.
You can make that point.
Yeah. And I agree. I think it's a good kind of compromise to the issue, and I think it more clearly sets out what is happening here, which is not a broad statement, but more of a narrow construction.
May I comment?
Sure.
I apologize.
You need to get to the microphone.
Candidly, the Medical Society doesn't necessarily take a position with respect to the title, but I would point out that to the extent that we refer to in the top line physician-assisted death, the definition of medical professional within the initiative itself is not limited to physicians. So I would ask the board take that into consideration. I don't mean to complicate things.
No, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So medical assisted?
Maybe medically assisted death?
Yeah.
I would perhaps submit medical assistance in dying.
Medical assistance in dying is fine with me, I think.
Well, then you're back to the same language. I mean, I don't know. Medical aid in dying. I mean, I really feel like that brings up, I think this one more clearly indicates that they are assisting you. Dying is more of a process to me, right? And death is the finality. And so I think when you say medical assistance in dying, you imply that, you know, there's this, I think that's where you wrap in all these other things, the hospice and the home health and, you know, all these other things that are made to make you comfortable in what is an inevitable thing that's going to happen.
I wonder if
I'm maybe getting a little philosophical.
No, understood. Sharon, do you have any views?
It's a tough one. I was playing around with sort of reversing order in terms of concerning death with medical assistance, but like you say, does that include other situations where individuals die and they're provided various levels of medical assistance without the assistance actually
causing the,
right. death, right? But I don't know that this terminology
prescription too
gets you away from that problem either. I mean,
what if we said medical professional assisted death, so that we don't use the term physician?
I don't know. What is a
medically assisted dying?
No, I mean, I'm fine with that either. I just prefer the word death over dying.
Understood.
So what? Where are we right now?
We're just having a discussion among the board. So
right now we have proposed language.
That medically assisted death. Okay.
We haven't taken action on it.
Right.
Whether there's something better, something worse.
Medically assisted dying would be one that would appeal to us more. Because it, as it was mentioned, it's, death is a process, particularly now with the science that we have. We almost have to flip a switch to accomplish it.
I know we try to do relatively short titles, but perhaps we could sort of combine the title and the first trailer to say the amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a right to obtain assistance from a medical professional to achieve death through the administration of a medical protocol.
I like that.
That would work for us.
Okay, you want to say it again?
An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a right to obtain assistance from a medical professional to achieve death through the administration of a medical protocol.
No one's going to accuse you of using a catchphrase.
I sure hope not. Quite the mouthful of a catchphrase. It could be shortened to say through a medical protocol. The administrative of, administration of is probably a necessary detail. And you could remove to obtain, so it's just a right to assistance.
I like that better.
Yeah, I do too. I think it...
Okay.
And then one other concern is if in terms of mentally competent adult, is that there's no requirement that at the time this occurs that a person be a mentally competent adult. And I think
absolutely. And I don't mean to cut you off, but yeah. I do, I just want to explain, I think we can get to that after we address just the title clause, because the title clause, we just simply can't fold in all the complications of the measure into that clause. And I think we can address concerns about voluntariness and competence later on in the title. And I didn't mean to cut you off, so if you want to continue speaking, please do.
But as to what we change, does anybody have a comment on that change?
I think it's more clear than what was there before.
Okay.
Thank you.
I agree. I think it's
and so that makes largely makes the next sentence.
It does, and we will move on to There's a lot of red ink that will be spilled, I think, in the next 30, 40 minutes. So
can you say that?
I move the changes as reflected on lines 1 and 2 of the screen.
I second it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. So now we get to the trailer.
Good. And I had several concerns about the first phrase in the trailer for a variety of reasons, in terms of declaring, in terms of the use of Coloradans, which I don't think is accurate. I don't know that the use of the term citizen sovereign is going to be helpful at all to voters. So in terms of having that in the title, and so I had a lot of changes anyway before we
got to that.
We changed the statement of single subject. So
Would you want to just go through your changes, or do you want to do them one at a time? I mean, I thought that phrase was just unnecessary in its entirety, but
I do. It's probably, I think the concept of who's entitled, who has now this right, is important. But obviously, I think we've described the vast majority of that phrase in now the statement of single subject. So maybe we just go to an approach of who has this right, and then we can work on from there.
Sure.
Okay, so why don't we just strike that phrase, the first phrase, and substitute something along the lines of specifying that mentally competent adults who are lawful residents of the United States possess the right, and that's very inartful. You could say specifying that the right belongs to mentally competent adults, or the right is possessed.
I like belongs to.
Okay, specifying that the right belongs to, and then we drop after United States. Possess the right. Because that's, I do believe that the staff draft was incorrect in terms of categorizing as Coloradans. It's, I think the measure would apply to anyone who comes to Colorado, as long as they're a lawful resident within the country.
Yes.
They could come to Colorado and exercise this right.
That was our intent.
I think that change is helpful. Do the opponents have a...
You had indicated you thought that mentally competent was inaccurate. Do you want to...
I think the proposal specifically states that someone does not have to remain mentally competent in order to use this provision. And so I think by saying that somebody has to be mentally competent, I think is misleading to the voters, because it causes the voters to believe that only people who are competent could take advantage of this, when that's not the case.
So what if it was specifying the right to enter into an agreement or something like that was reserved for mentally competent? Do you think that would be a little bit, would that satisfy your concerns?
I think you've got to put in there that that regardless of competency, somebody could be utilizing this.
Well, we get into that later on in terms of some of the other phrases about it no longer being mentally competent. And so I think we can address that later on. I'm not adverse to perhaps tweaking the language that we're talking about on lines 5 and 6 about, you know, entering into an agreement.
See, part of the part of our effort in defining mentally competent, defining citizen sovereign as a mentally competent person, was to avoid having to say a person who's mentally competent, or the declarant, or the qualified individual, or, you know, some other phrase naming that person.
Understood.
But the name that we can use, yes.
I agree with Sharon. I think we can address sort of generally who falls under this provision, and then later on explain how I think it's called a conditional time deferred MAID. We can explain that process, and I hope address the concern that that agreement can apply to those who have fallen, who've become incompetent over time.
And while I understand the measure uses that term citizen sovereign to describe these mentally competent adults, to Joe Elector out there, I mean, that term will not mean anything to them. And I don't think it's very useful to have it in the title. Mm-hmm. And that I think more people will be able to understand a mentally competent adult rather than talking about a citizen sovereign that most individuals wouldn't have a clue what that means without actually getting into the text of your measure or perhaps the Blue Book analysis. And that doesn't always happen.
Right. Right. I think even beyond that, the term citizen sovereign, if people do think they have an understanding of it, it's going to be a very catchphrase type understanding of it because it's a phrase the media will commonly use to describe all kinds of sort of activities.
There are groups of people who use the term citizen sovereign, I believe, to refer to all kinds of things like immunity from taxation and freedom from certain laws imposed by the states in the United States, and in fact try to assert those in filings in court. So I am a little bit concerned about using that term, and I'd rather stick to the language we have here. So I think this is a good change. I would move the changes as reflected on lines 2 through 6 of the screen.
Just in terms of the idea we were talking about, saying, you know, to enter into an agreement or something along those, whether or not it might be helpful, instead of says that the right belongs to, perhaps that the right can be exercised by mentally competent, because then I think that gets to the idea that only a mentally competent person can enter into one of these agreements. And then you have the whole other issue of at some point in time after the agreement's been entered into, if they're no longer mentally competent, but the right can be exercised, and whether or
but
whether
the right is to get the assistance from a medical professional,
which you have to do by the agreement.
But you're getting the assistance potentially at a time that you're not competent. I guess that's my concern.
But you're exercising that right to be able to do that when you are competent.
Yeah, but if the right we're talking about is the right to assistance to achieve death, that right to the assistance to achieve death could be happening at a time that you're not mentally competent.
Okay. And then maybe belongs is better. So, yeah. Never mind.
I think our goal here is to identify sort of the general class of people to which this provision will apply, and then I think we ought to specify the contracting provisions later in the title. So I would suggest we keep this language and then move on and see if we can't come to a compromise about how the operation of the contracting language works.
Okay. So did you move the language?
So I did. I'll move the language, the changes as reflected on lines 2 through 6 of the screen.
I'll second that.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so then on line 4, you have the reference to the citizen sovereign, which I believe should be removed, and whether or not we will work it to... And it also includes the medical aid in dying terminology, which we probably want to remove. So perhaps we could make it read along the lines of protecting any person who provides such medical assistance.
Well, part of what we were trying to cover was also people who are providing moral support and social assistance, the family members are in a house where that is being administered. So it's not just medical professionals that we're trying to make sure won't be prosecuted for what is no longer a crime.
I also don't really like the word protecting. Can we just say exempting or something more legalistic?
Well, you could say granting immunity.
That's fine.
Too.
Yeah.
Granting immunity.
I'm not hearing you, Mercedes.
Okay, so let's take out medical. I'm still playing around with it, but let's take out the word medical there on line four. And I think take out such. So provides assistance.
In exercising the right?
Provides assistance to a person exercising the right. And I I guess there's the question of whether or not we still need, first of all, we'd be striking the language about assisting a citizen sovereign in obtaining medical aid in dying. I think that comes out because now we've covered it by a person exercising the right.
Yeah, I think we'd strike the remainder of that clause, wouldn't we?
Is it important to talk about what we're granting immunity from, though?
I would ask not to take out the criminal and civil at this point.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was, that's right.
So whether we leave the from civil and criminal liability and professional discipline, and then whether or not we need to have a reference upon presenting documentation or to say upon, because I don't really want to get into the details of what the documentation, if we have that kind of language, I think we just say upon presenting certain documentation.
I don't even think you need.
Or you just drop it completely.
Yeah, I would say drop it completely.
I
mean, they're immune.
I
under
agree.
Whatever
the yeah. terms of.
Right.
Yeah, the documentation is just a method of proving.
Yeah.
The condition upon which immunity rests, which is that the right was exercised. So,
right.
Okay, are we losing the definition that this is a medical protocol with this rewording?
I don't believe so. When we refer to the right, we're referring to the right as defined by the title clause, which is a right to assistance from medical professional to achieve death through a medical protocol.
Which it will be specified by the medical professionals involved. It's not what's popularly referred to as mercy killing or, this spousal love fulfillment of their wishes to help their loved one pass by smothering him with a pillow. We're eliminating anything except a medical procedure, and we want to make sure that that's clear.
I understand your concern. I think that is clear when we say that the right is only to assistance from a medical professional to achieve death through a medical protocol.
Okay. Okay.
So then if we're comfortable with this language, I would move the changes as they appear on lines 4 to line 8 on the screen.
A second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
So this next line is the one that I think we could use, and then pretty much, I guess where I was headed on that first one is that I didn't know that we even really needed it. Where we have specifying the right belongs to competent adults, you could about combine those two. I mean, aren't you saying the same thing here?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what?
See, where you have up above, you have specifying the right belongs to mentally competent adults who are lawful residents.
Lines 2 through 3.
Okay, and then you come down, and the one we're about to start on says allowing you to enter an agreement.
Well,
You are no longer. I mean, couldn't you put those together?
Oh, my impression is that it was too challenging to combine those two concepts, and that might be easier to sort of specify the agreement provisions of the proposal here rather than try to fold them into the first trailing clause.
Yeah, and I think that it would be useful to keep them separate because this ability to secure the aid in dying at some future date is unique.
I suppose you could say, Suzanne, if you wanted to go that route of combining the two, specifying that the right belongs to a mentally competent adult who are lawful residents of the United States or those that have entered into a prior agreement while mentally competent. But again, I think it might be easier and more clear for the voter if we flesh that out in a separate clause.
That's fine. So then we want to get rid of citizen sovereign.
And I also agree that I think it's important to have this as a separate statement because, again, in terms of that emphasis, that this is different. Sort of a circumstance where they've entered into the agreement when they're competent and then they're no longer competent and the concerns that have been raised, I think it provides an opportunity to deal with those concerns here. Okay.
If I could make a comment, and that the concern is that the first clause deals with people who are getting to use that, to use the lethal dose, and those people are not required to be competent. So it would probably be more accurate to the voters to take out competent in the first clause, but point out in the second clause that they have to be competent when entering the agreement, but do not have to remain competent to use it.
I understand that concern. My concern is this. There are sort of their rights and then there are methods of exercising those rights. And I understand that your concern is that somebody who exercises that right at time A may be incompetent at time B when that right is actually completed. And so I think the board is trying to capture all these concerns in a fair and concise way, and in my view I'd like to at least try to fit that into this next clause and see what we can do. That's my view on it. I don't know if the other board members want to chime in.
And I think I just remain in the minority, not enough to vote against it. But I agree that saying that the right belongs to a mentally competent adult implies the right to assistance from a medical professional to achieve death. The right of the mentally competent adult is limited to the right to enter the contract. At the time that you have the medically assisted death, you are not necessarily exercising that right as a mentally competent adult. I think the statement is inaccurate when you apply it back to the first statement. And that a first statement is the only one we've talked about at the time that we start out with that clause. And I think all of this is wrapped up in the agreement. And so that's where I was headed with it. But again, I mean, I understand where the other members are, but I think that's really what she's talking about. And I tend to agree that that putting it there as the first statement makes it look like you have to be mentally competent at the time that you receive the assistance. Now, we explain it later, so I don't think it's a... It, it completely flaws the question. I just question its placement.
But well, I could be agreeable to removing the reference to mentally competent on line 3, but then I think we have to get into more detail down where we are now in lines 5-6, not only talking about an agreement to deal with it in the future, but just in terms of entering into an agreement to begin with, and there you have the mentally competent. But
what if we said this? The right may be exercised by mentally competent adults or lawful residents of the United States or through contract or something along those lines. And then later we will specify how that contract works.
You always have to have
You always have to have the contract. You have to have an agreement.
Well, maybe you can help with that. I thought that there was a right here that would just be communicated verbally to a medical professional that might not necessarily be reflected in a conditional MAID document.
You're basically right. The idea is that the physician or the medical professional comes to a voluntary agreement with the individual who's exercising their right to assisted death, and that's one level. That's what exists now in Oregon, California, and these other states that have passed these laws. We were trying to make clear was that it takes the next step, that while you're voluntarily seeking a peaceful death, and you find a physician who voluntarily agrees to assist you, some documentation will be required that it was voluntary. And the provision on, I think it's the last provision in the proposal, says that legislation can be written if the legislature feels necessary to spell out a little bit about what sort of documentation might be desirable. The contract, obviously, for future work is much more detailed. You can have a gentleman's agreement, if you will, if you're self-administering and the physician is just merely attending.
So my pitch is that we say that the right may be exercised by mentally competent adults who are lawful residents of the United States or may be governed by agreement.
Because I think that'd be fine, because then it's either governed by an agreement or you were competent at the time that you had this oral agreement. I mean, then it's not a conditional one, right?
Exactly, so. Yeah. And then we can later specify the concern raised by the opponents that you can be competent at time A but not at time B when the agreement...
I think it's accurate at that point.
Right. Okay. Sharon, what do you think?
Governed is it's probably the best way we can do, but what I was trying to avoid was the requesting permission. This is a right that's being asserted.
Yeah, I would tweak the language here a little bit, and maybe this will satisfy you, that the right may be exercised by mentally competent adults or lawful residents of the United States or by agreement.
And perhaps I'm just confused, but it seems like you have to have an agreement in all circumstances because the medical professional has to agree to, so it may be a verbal agreement, but
yes.
There's always an agreement. It's a question, it seems like whether the conditional agreement is probably more along the lines of what we're thinking in terms of a written agreement, a contract, something along those lines. But at least my understanding is that there's always an agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean,
it has to be.
Though a mentally competent adult wants to exercise his or her right,
they can't force
a medical professional to Exactly.
Give them a or administer whatever the medical protocol is.
Right.
And so, so I'm concerned about adding the language or maybe governed by an agreement.
What if we do this, specifying that the right belongs to and may be governed by agreement? Does that work? I think what we're trying to do in this section is to imply that at the time the right is exercised, the person is necessarily competent. That's all we're trying to do here, and then we can move on later to explain the agreement.
I just think that you're still implying that it's governed by somebody who's mentally competent. I mean, here's the thing. You could have an agreement that's contingent upon your husband making that determination. Then you get a divorce, and 40 years later, your ex-husband gets to make that decision for you. You are not competent. It is potentially not really voluntary. And I think that
chances are the medical professional wouldn't agree to it.
That's exactly it.
We don't know that. I mean, I'm just saying that by saying that, you know, this is being exercised by a competent adult, I just feel like you're implying something that is potentially not true. And I don't think you're going to fix it. I just think it needs to come out, but then be put down there where we talk about what goes into the making of this agreement instead of implying that these people who are exercising this right to medical assisted suicide are mentally competent.
So would you just delete the clause specifying through by agreement? That might be a way to fix it. I don't know.
Yeah. I just don't think you need it because I think you get into it down below.
That would be the direction I'm leaning, is that it's kind of two general concepts. One is you are competent when you do it, and the other one is you make the arrangements when you're competent, but it's actually administered when you're not.
Sharon, what do you think about eliminating that clause?
Well, I think if you eliminate that clause, then you have to move the discussion about the agreement up, because I don't think it makes much sense to talk about first granting immunity to somebody providing assistance when you really haven't described how this is happening. And so the way I was leaning before we got to the suggestion that we just take out that phrase that's stricken on lines 2 and 3 was sort of going back to a distinction between the right and exercising the right, and whether or not you could take, if that phrase stayed in, you could say specifying that the right belongs to adults who are lawful residents of the United States. And so the phrase is talking about that the right and may be exercised by mentally competent, may be exercised by agreement between mentally competent adults and medical professionals. I'm sorry.
Susan Sovereign fix it.
I'm leaning towards Suzanne's idea that we don't need it. We can just move up the provisions discussing the contracting. Okay.
And then just move that other part down.
Although I do think we...
Frankly, I don't think it's terribly central to the provision that specifying those who may exercise... I mean, it's common that there are all kinds of rights that may by law only be affected after you achieve, the age of emancipation and all that stuff, and that you're mentally competent. I mean, that's sort of a background notion that most people understand. Yeah, so I think allowing a mentally competent adult to enter into an agreement with a medical professional, I think we need to get rid of medical aid in dying. And I just don't want to restate the title clause all over again. To exercise the right at a future time when the individual may no longer be mentally competent.
Yeah.
They kind of have the same concern, a right to assistance from the
And I think I'm fine with this phrase. It's just bothering me a little bit. We're talking about this particular type of situation, but we really haven't talked about the other circumstance that where this right's going to be exercised. It's sort of, you know, a voluntary agreement between a mentally you know, having some statement about how the right in general is
what if you just
exercised,
say,
and then this phrase is talking about sort of exercising it in the future.
How about we say allowing a mentally competent adult to exercise the right or to enter into an agreement with a medical professional to exercise the right at a future time when the individual may no longer be mentally competent and the conditions specified in the agreement are met. Starting there, and then maybe we can shorten or divide it up.
This is the reason we're here now instead of 4 months ago, is that trying to figure out how we capture the voluntariness of the agreement when you're competent and when you're administering when you're competent is separate from having it administered when you're not competent.
And is the here's the other problem I'm having here. The agreement is not necessarily with a particular medical professional. The agreement is more like a will that just states, you know, if these conditions are met, these are my wishes. And so expecting that any medical professional who voluntarily wishes to assist in carrying out those wishes may do so and may be immune from prosecution. So that's maybe a little inaccurate, too. So maybe it would be to enter into an agreement to exercise the right at a future time when the individual may no longer, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that addresses both the temporal issue and the fact that the agreement might be in effect at a later time when incompetency services.
You can replicate that and put in language.
I can, yeah. Allowing a mentally competent adult to exercise the right or to enter into an agreement and strike with a medical professional to exercise the right at a future time when the individual may no longer be, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
That makes a lot more sense. Because there you're still talking about two different, you know, exercising the right.
What's that phrase I just
used? Yeah, I think... I think it's accurate now, so I'm...
Future.
I think that's accurate.
Well, before we change our minds, I might move the change. I move the changes as reflected on lines 2 through 6 of the screen.
And also on lines 8 through 10?
Yes, and also on lines 8 through 10. I move all changes on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye. And then I just, my final suggestion, I'm satisfied with the title. I would just delete the final clause because we've decided that the documentation is not necessarily central and I think is a detail that I expect voters to maybe, if they're curious about, look at the measure. But I'm certainly open to discussing that.
Well, and I don't think this, even if they look at the measure, it just says the legislature can do something. So I don't think that really helps.
I'm in agreement. I think if you remove that phrase, then you've got to insert an and up on line 5 after the semicolon and before granting.
We did that to respect the efforts made by the legislature.
in the last two sessions.
It just maybe isn't a central feature
right.
Of the measure.
All right. You want to move that change and then I'll read it?
Yeah, I'll move the change as reflected on lines 5 through 7.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. So now it reads, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a right to assistance from a medical professional to achieve death through a medical protocol and in connection therewith, allowing a mentally competent adult to exercise the right or to enter into an agreement to exercise the right at a future time when the individual may no longer be mentally competent and the conditions specified in the agreement are met, and granting immunity from civil and criminal liability and professional discipline to any person who provides assistance to a person exercising the right.
I guess I'm wondering where the word voluntary is.
Involuntary?
No, I mean making sure that we're referring to this, the whole arrangement is voluntary.
Well, you're mentally competent entering into an agreement. So.
Okay.
Are you? Oh, yeah.
The agreement has to be voluntary to be valid. So I don't. I mean, we typically wouldn't get into.
Is there?
I don't think this is necessary, but we could say in granting immunity from civil and criminal liability and professional discipline to any person who voluntarily provides assistance to a person exercising the right. But that,
so if they involuntarily provide it, they're not immune from liability.
I don't know how you could compel someone. I think as written, this is accurate. I think you have to assume that those assisting are going to be doing so voluntarily, and I think...
Well, even if they're not, I suppose they're still immune if they're involuntarily doing it.
And the description of who may exercise the right, I think, implies fairly that the right will only be exercised in certain circumstances, and I understand that some might view certain circumstances as not being voluntary, but I think it's aptly described there when the right may be exercised and how.
I agree. I think the voluntary part of it is really, quite frankly, for the ad. I mean, if that's how you want to, you know, advertise your initiative, that's fine. But everything else is, you know, specified in the question.
So on line 3, it doesn't imply, I'm not reading it, and I'm questioning this, that we're allowing a mentally incompetent adult at a future date to enter into the agreement. In other words, in connection therewith, allowing a mentally competent adult to exercise the right or to enter into the agreement to exercise the right at a future time. Are we implying that
when the individual may no longer be mentally competent and the conditions specified in the agreement are met.
So we're not implying that they can enter at that time. We're implying that they need to have that done prior to that incompetence.
And just in terms of the sentence structure, mentally competent adult goes to both the phrases to exercise the right, to enter into an agreement. So okay. That's
just
your subject.
To clarify if that's what everybody's reading. Okay.
Yeah.
I understand. Unfortunately, American English is sometimes imprecise as to grammar. I think the most natural reading is that at a future time modifies exercise the right as opposed to enter into because of the order of the modifiers.
Okay, good.
All right.
Okay.
I want to clarify.
So I think I would move that we adopt the title to proposed initiative 2015-2016 number 100 as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
You guys want to take a recess?
Yeah.
All right. What, 15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 15-minute recess.
Thank you.
Thanks.